Hello everyone and welcome to a very special episode of After Dark. Not only is it the 127th episode of After Dark, Longbox Heroes After Dark nonetheless, it is also the much-awaited Gallifrey Birds Roman numeral 4.
Yes, 4. I can't believe we have 3 of these in the hopper.
Right. I can't believe we have 8 more to go.
Who knows? We can make this... We could extend this if you wanted, Joe.
Well, it is successful, I will say that. The numbers bear that out.
Do they really?
They do.
We have number bears?
Yes, we do have number bears. Were you... You're older than me. Do you remember when you were a child? I do. That they gave you, like, these counting bears to help you with, your addition and subtraction?
Your gazintas?
Yeah, your gazintas. You weren't allowed to take your shoes off at school, so they gave you, these oversized, hard plastic bears that you would use as visual representation. It was a thing I remember from my kindergarten days.
We didn't have those.
Right.
I don't even know about them. I don't know anything about number bears.
All right. But no, usually, we'll get a couple extra listens, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, on the Gallifrey Birds episodes. Because as much as people enjoy me talking about Doctor Who, and we'll get to that later.
Oh boy.
They love you talking about the world of professional wrestling, or sports entertainment.
And if there's anybody who loves talking about sports entertainment, it's this guy.
Right. And it's nice that you get a chance to, talk about a real sport.
Right. Instead of curling.
I was going to say the NFL, but...
Don't start. The draft is this week. Are you watching?
And I'm stealing this joke from my my friend Slade on Twitter. Don't you mean the NFL superstar shakeup?
All right, I like that. I'm stealing that too.
All right.
But yeah, I always joke because my brother's a big Pinball and Ice fan. And I'll always go the hierarchy goes NFL games, basketball, baseball, golf, Magic the Gathering tournament.
Okay. It was on ESPN, the Ocho.
Yeah, except after golf comes where the NFL picks the players that they want. Then Magic the Gathering. Then, lumberjack competitions. Then pinball and ice. And he gets very mad at me.
Do they still have Magic the Gathering on TV?
I don't think so, but I like to just do it to get them hot.
Monster Jam is on Fox Sports 1.
Oh, boy.
I think that's higher than your Pinball on Ice.
It probably is.
And I think ESPN Classic still shows old episodes of AWA wrestling from the 80s.
Oh, God.
to this day. You could turn it on at any point and it's still on.
With new episodes?
No.
Well, if I haven't seen them, they're new to me, right, Joe?
Correct. So,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, go ahead.
I was going to say, so I watched Spring Stampede 1994.
Right, Spring Stampede World Championship Wrestling presents Spring Stampede 1994.
All right, so let me get into this because I'm looking at my notes. And the first thing that jumps out at me is that I don't know if you know this, but certain talent moved from company to company in wrestling.
That's correct.
So for literally, and this is no joke, as sometimes I give you a gentle ribbing about wrestling.
What?
I had no idea Mean Gene ever worked for WCW.
Oh my goodness.
I thought he was a lifer at WWF, WWE. Do you know what I mean?
He was one of the first people to jump. And obviously we'll get into this shortly. He and Bobby the Brain, jumped officially before Hogan.
Okay.
They were some of the first acquisitions of this era of WCW.
Okay. Because I knew Bobby had jumped because I had seen some stuff on Monday nights and stuff like that of him doing announcing. So that was always my, you know, like I knew it, but Mean Gene, and that broke my heart. I always wanted to think that, like, you know, he played for one team his whole life and then retired.
Now,
but he didn't.
See, conversely, and see, this all comes around play, is we talk about old episodes of AWA, WWF back in 1984, when they culled, like, all these other promotions for talent, AWA was one of the people that they hit the hardest, and the three people that they took right off the bat were Hulkster, Mean Gene, and Bobby the Brain.
That's like your trifecta right there.
It's almost as though history repeated itself almost 10 years exactly to the day.
Because you got their number one talent, like, in the ring, their number one talent on the mic, and their number one announcer, right?
Well, at the time, Bobby was, like, the top heel manager.
Oh, okay. He didn't announce for WWE at all at that time? Like he did?
He did later. He didn't really start announcing almost full-time until, like, 1988. So for the first 40 years that he was in WWF, he was strictly a manager.
Gotcha. So it all starts, and Aaron Neville sings the national anthem, right?
Right.
And he's doing his, like, you know, the in and out. I love that. He's got a sleeveless leopard print shirt on and a cowboy hat. And I did not know Aaron Neville juiced, but I think he flexed the sleeves right off his shirt because I couldn't believe how big his arms were.
Well, again, to perform at there was no testing at that time.
For singers?
Right. Now, and again, you say this, to put things into perspective, Aaron Neville also sang the national anthem at WWE SummerSlam 8 months prior.
Oh my God, so now they're stealing talent too?
Yes.
Like the, oh, fantastic, right?
And also not the father of current World Wrestling Entertainment superstar, just Neville. That's not his kid.
Oh, it's not.
No.
They look so much alike.
Right.
I like looking into a mirror. So Bobby the Brain is in a striking red blazer, which I love. And the first thing I notice as they show the ring is that it's got another ramp. It's not a ramp so much as it's a runway going to it again.
Yeah.
Which that's what I missed the runway. To wrestling rings, like the ramp. I'm done with the ramp. I want the runway. And once again, I'm thinking to myself, I have a vague memory of a runway and someone yelling, "I'm gonna win," and my mind immediately goes, "Is that this pay per view?"
It is not.
And spoiler alert, it wasn't. Also, I noticed that I didn't like the turnbuckles. The turnbuckles were weird. They looked like little yellow marshmallow peeps.
Now, see, this is so funny that you say this.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the many wrestling podcasts that I listen to recently went through a change where they were talking mostly about WWF stuff, like old WWF stuff from like this era and earlier, and it was called Letters from Kayfabe. Just this past Friday, they relaunched it as Letters from Center Stage, which is where they filmed all the WCW TV, talking about WCW TV, and there was a lengthy segment on the show talking about how the weird yellow turnbuckles in WCW were disconcerting.
Yeah, well, I was like, immediately, I'm like, something's off in the ring, and I don't know. Oh, it's the turnbuckles.
Yes.
Why are they shaped like that? They're not very protecting, as far as I'm concerned, because they went, if you fell from them on top, they'd protect you, but I don't know.
Well, they didn't employ George the Animal Steel as a turnbuckle tester.
Aha! Oh, thank God. So, first up, the first match is Johnny B. Bad.
A favorite of yours.
I'm like, right out of the gate, they're giving away the main event. Right up front, right? So he comes out in this raspberry cowboy outfit that is fantastic.
Right.
And he's got the glitter sticks again, and he gets up on the turnbuckle and puts it very low, and glitter goes everywhere.
His bad blaster.
Yeah, I always forget the name of his blaster.
His glitter cannon.
It's glitter cannon. But then I like, because anytime anybody rolled around in the outside the ring later in the show, they were covered in glitter. Like they were, you know, like breading chicken. With all their sweat, they have Johnny B. Badge glitter all over them.
I'll say this, listeners of this, and also listeners of What Happened When, you know Todd does not listen to other wrestling podcasts. Just keep that in mind, one. And two, this would actually become something of a similar problem when Goldust would debut in WWF. Because he would come out, he would do his whole entrance, and they would drop, like, the gold dust from the ceiling, right?
Right.
And then, like, the next six matches, people would just have, like, gold glitter all over them.
That's fantastic. That is a way to get your brand, like the whole show.
Like, what the hell is that all over that guy? Oh, yeah, gold dust wrestled six matches ago.
Mm-hmm. So then the best part of it is Bobby the Brain. He's like, oh, he's getting that stuff out everywhere. He's a glitter bug. And I was like, every time I see the Brain and listen to the Brain, I'm like, I'm just stealing his shtick, and I didn't even know it. I didn't even know it. So then out comes Dog the Bounty Hunter to fight him, right?
Okay, sure. I'm not going to correct you.
Is that who it is? What?
I'm not going to correct you. Go ahead.
But he, like, I don't know who stole whose gimmick, but this guy is Dog the Bounty Hunter. I know who he is. He's the yoga guy, right?
Right.
Right. But I looked at him and he comes out. What?
The yoga guy. I'm laughing.
I'm telling, that's all I know is our good buddy DJ talks about DDP yoga, right? Doesn't he do that?
He was, if you remember, Todd, he was the villain in the WCW documentary Ready to Rumble as well.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
That's right.
See, I just remember the dancers? Rose McGowan was one of the dancers.
Nitro Girls.
The Nitro Girls, because that's really what, they really should have done a sequel. Ready to Rumble 2, the story of the Nitro Girls.
They still can.
Oh, they're not all dead, I guess.
And we're off on tangents, but as of this recording, today, 17 years to the day, is when David Arquette won the WCW World Title.
Wow. With the greatest day in wrestling history, by the way.
In a match where he was tag team partners with Dallas Page, and Dallas Page was the champion. But the rules of the match was whoever scored the pinfall was the champion afterwards.
Okay.
And David Arquette was the champion.
Okay, I guess. I don't know.
Go ahead.
But then, now who was with Diamond Dallas at the time?
The Diamond Doll, a.k.a. Kimberly, his real life at the time wife.
At the time, so they're no longer together?
Correct.
Wait a minute. I just have to ask this. Are you telling me a wrestling marriage didn't stand the test of time?
They were together for a very long time.
Okay. Just curious, because I know how well, you know, things work like that.
Just to interject here as well, she was also in 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Really?
You would remember her as the girl from when he goes in the speed dating thing.
Right.
And she has her nipple hanging out of her dress.
That's her?
Yeah.
Wow, I'm glad I saw her before she became a huge star.
Right.
But and then she pays off the Brain with I guess a diamond studded something.
Okay.
Because they never show it. All they do is say it's his initials, diamond something.
Right.
And I'm like, they should have showed it. I want to see what it was. And all I really remember from this match, because I was so dazzled by Johnny B. Badd's outfit, which was fantastic, amazing, was that for like a good section of the match, Johnny Shiv and Bobby the Brain.
Johnny Shiv?
Yeah, isn't his name Johnny Shiv or something?
Yes, that's his name, Johnny Shiv.
Okay, I don't know.
Tony Schiavone.
Oh, okay, Tony Shiv, gotcha. So we're discussing whether it was a stomach buster or a gut buster.
Right.
Because they were like, he's like, oh, you know what that is? He's like, He's like, it's a stomach buster. And he's like, whichever way. And Bray's like, no, Shiv says it's a gut buster. And he's like, it's a stomach buster. And he's like, well, isn't a gut, and there were semantics. And I was like, was actually making me laugh because I love when Brain does like stuff like that. And then once again, Brain says, if Johnny loses this match, do you think he's going to be Johnny B. Mad? And I'm like, God, Brain, I love the way you think. I could have been announcing these wrestling matches back in the day. So did Johnny B. Mad ended up winning, right?
Johnny B. Mad did win the match.
Okay, and that furthers his career. He went on to win the belt, I guess, maybe?
Well, you know, he did have a modicum of success before contract disputes and so forth over the next 2 years would leave him to leave the World Championship Wrestling to go to WWF, where he became the Wild Man Mark Marrow.
Okay.
Under his real name.
That makes me sad, because I think he could have had a great run as Little Richard or Johnny B. Bad.
Well, this was the beginning of them starting to tone down his outrageous outfits.
What?
Yes.
Why would you take away the best part of his wrestling?
The fashion.
I am all about the wrestling fashion. There's going to be more critiquing on wrestling fashion.
And that's what we're here for.
Then Mean Gene and Jesse discuss that they have a steak dinner on one of the matches, and it made me sad because we never get around to our steak dinners. So I had to pause the show for a little bit and get over it.
How crazy is this? We're one match in to the show, and there's already so many parallels to our own life.
It's fantastic. It's like either wrestling became us or we became wrestling. I'm not sure which one it is. But then the next match is Flying Brian Pillman.
Right.
Who comes out in a glorious Dallas Cowboys jacket. This is the only thing that I can gather. I don't know if he's a fan or what, but it looks just like a Dallas.
He actually played for the Bengals.
Did he really?
In the mid-80s, yes.
Okay. Oh, yes, because... Is this? I have to turn the page and check my notes, because I think Bobby the Brain called him a quitter. He's like, Pillman's a quitter, and Tony Shiv is like, what do you mean he's a quitter? He's like, well, he played football, and how many Super Bowl rings does he have? And Shiv is like, none. He's like, see, I told you, he's a quitter. And I'm like, I don't know if that logic plays out, Brain, but I love it. I absolutely love it.
Oh boy.
So then out comes Lord Steven Regal.
Yes.
And this is the baby face because he's British to me. So he's got to be the baby face in this, right? Because, you know, the doctor's the baby face and he's British. So that's the way my world works. And he comes out with his buddy, British Mr. Fuji, right?
Okay.
That's immediately what I saw. What's his name? Sir William?
Sir William, yes.
Sir William is Mr. British Fuji.
All right.
British Mr. Fuji. That's immediately what I thought. And I knew things were dire for Steven Regal because he had a bad wheel. And you know how I knew?
Was it heavily taped up?
He had one piece of gauze loosely fitted to his leg. And I was like, oh, my God, he's going to have to fight through it. He's going to have to be a real man's man to get through this. And
did you have help with some of these lines?
What? I don't know what you're talking about.
Fair enough.
So then while all this is going on, I don't notice that Bobby the Brain isn't commentating the match. It's all Tony Shiv at this point.
Okay.
And you find out that Bobby had stepped on his headset somehow. And he's like, well, Tony, you shouldn't have left it where, like, you moved it. I had it right here, and you moved it, and it fell. And then, like, Tony's like, well, what are you standing for anyway, Bray? And he's like, well, when his lordship come out, you stand for it. You're out of respect for royalty. And I'm like, where does he come up with this shit? Like, off the top of his head, I'm like, he's so, like, skeezy. It's amazing.
That's why he's the Brain.
Right. No, I get it. I understand it. And I loved him from my days when I saw a little bit of him in the WWE. But it's just like, I don't know how to put it. Like, cause his best effort, I think, like I said, was the one with JR, you know, the crazy one with, the Royal Rumble.
Right. With Gorilla Monsoon. Sure.
With Gorilla Monsoon. I'm sorry. But it's anytime I see him, the best, or listen to him, the best thing to come is he does it effortlessly. Do you know what I mean?
Right, like, he's not fumfering for words. Or if he is fumfering for words, he's supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And just like this phrase during the match, he's like, Tony, he's like, look at him out there. And the one thing I will say, I'm actually gonna talk about a little bit of wrestling in this
what?
Match, is that this was a very like technical, almost like actual wrestling match.
Right.
Like, and I don't mean like wrestling in the, like off the ropes and then, you know, somersaults. And this
Rappling.
Was a lot of like moves into moves. And I actually really enjoyed that because it was actually kind of cool.
Holy
to
shit.
To see some, what are you saying?
And you enjoying actual wrestling. Go ahead.
It was kind of cool to see, like I said, he's British. I root for the British. So, and he's just like doing like all these maneuvers and like counters and I'm like it just looked very interesting, especially in all these WCW matches that I've seen up to this point, where it's just a lot of like bruisers and stuff like that. It's like it stood out to me. But while they were doing that effortlessly, Bobby shoots out, he's like, Tony, you know there's a counter for every hold, a hold for every counter, and a lunch counter for every person you know. And I'm like, what the hell is this?
Oh.
But I'm completely entertained, Joe. And what is it? I think at one point he says at this point, because about a match later, that he thinks Dustin Rhodes is in the building because he smells him and he knows the rodeo isn't in town. So. I'm trying to look over. Then about into this match, we get to see Pillman's butt because Regal grabs the tights and pulls them down, which is like the first of two butt shots that we get in this pay per view, which blew my mind. And also, Brain says at some point there's. And I like the way he calls people humanoids.
Right, that's a classic Bobbyism.
He's like, look at this. Because somebody's holding up one of these humanoids out there is holding up a USA sign because he doesn't know where he is.
That was his, like, pencil neck geeks.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
But it was really interesting. And you know what? I really need to write down more who wins these matches.
This one went to a time limit draw.
Oh, time limit draw. That was I forgot to write that down because I found that interesting. It felt like, because they threw each other out of the ring and they tried to get back in, and one guy, Pillman, I think, pinned Regal trying to get it before the time ran out. And it looked like maybe they were trying for getting back in the ring and starting the count with 2 seconds left, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So it would be like 1, 2, and then the bell would ring, and then the hand would come down for the third, and then it would be like, oh, a weird ending to a match. But it didn't work out because it seemed like they couldn't get in the ring fast enough. So I don't know if that was what was planned, but in my mind, that looked like what was planned, if that makes any sense.
Right. So to kind of give you a little bit of backstory on that sort of thing. So Steven Regal was the TV champion coming into this contest.
Right.
And a lot of times the TV championship would be the title that was defended on TV. And more times than not, it would be for TV time remaining. Or it would be you get to wrestle a champ, but the title is only on the line for the first 5 minutes or 10 minutes of the match, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Then that transitioned to, you know, as matches became shorter and shorter on TV, you know, you're going to wrestle a TV champ, it's going to be a 10-minute time limit, goes to the time limit. You're going to rematch, it's a 15-minute time limit, goes to a time limit draw. Now, the third time that you guys wrestle, it's no time limit, there must be a winner, blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
And that was, the TV title was more the title that they would do that with. They were the, quote-unquote, best wrestler on TV.
Ah, I see what you're saying. But I found that interesting. I didn't know like how that ended. So the next match is the Chicago Street Fight.
Yes.
With the Nasty Boys, who apparently are the gang movie Warriors extras.
Okay.
That's what they look like to me.
Right.
Versus Cactus Jack and the star of my favorite video game of all time, Max Payne. But who's from the state of Euphoria, by the way?
Correct.
Which I don't know. I don't know where that is, but I found that amusing when I heard that. Now, to critique anything about this match,
All right.
Is because it's not a match.
It's a street fight.
It's a street fight. And I have to admit, this was one of the more brutal street fights or matches or whatever it is I've ever seen. Because I'm wondering how many concussions people got during this match.
A lot.
Because I joke around a lot while I'm reviewing wrestling here.
What?
But this one made me ill at times.
Okay.
Like some of the stuff that they were doing. And I don't mean like I was like dying or anything like that. But I was like, oh, like that. Like you can't fake that. I don't know what's happening there, but that looked really painful. And all the stuff that was going on, I'm like, it's just crazy. And then at one point, they go into this merch stand. And I felt really bad for the merch stand guy because I don't know if it's going to come out of his check,
sure,
all the merch. But they busted up the merch table and merch went everywhere. And then he tried to stick a shirt down his throat. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is terrible. And then they were talking like there was more weapons laying around than in Tonya Harding's house. I was like, ooh, at the time, it was a timely Tonya Harding joke. But then at one point, they have a table on the runway. And I forget who it was because my mind broke when it happened. Was somebody was getting somebody up to do a move on the table, and the table just snapped.
Right, it just like collapsed under their weight.
Right, and they just went sprawling everywhere. And then it was shortly after that, somebody came out with a shovel, with Brain screaming, where do they get a shovel? I mean, the only thing that would be funnier is if somebody found a bicycle. That's the only thing I can think of.
That would be several years later.
Ah, okay. But in the end, it's just like he just taking a shovel to the head. And I'm like, I know you can do the whole thing where you whack the shovel on the ground close to the guy's head and make it look like you're doing it. But I feel like he was hitting him in the head with the shovel.
All right.
And I felt bad for all the gentlemen involved in this match because it was pretty brutal. And my question for you is this where like hardcore wrestling kind of started?
Not really, but this was the first time in a very long time that WCW kind of let this sort of thing play. And a lot of it is surrounded by Cactus Jack. Mm-hmm. Maybe about a year or so ago, a year prior to this, they kind of gave Cactus Jack a singles push where all of his matches would have this sort of kind of chaotic feel to it.
Right.
And this was the first time in many years that we saw this sort of thing in WCW. ECW was like really blowing up at this point in time. And actually, and strangely enough, WCW and ECW had a weird working arrangement where a lot of guys would wrestle on ECW shows. Most notably, Cactus Jack. I'm trying to think. Brian Pillman wrestled there once or twice. Steve Austin wrestled there once or twice. And it would just kind of be like a weird thing that guys would pop up intermediately, and a lot of that style would kind of bleed over into WCW.
Gotcha. I just wondered because I didn't know how much of it was before that. But I gotcha. So the next match is the Fabulous Muda.
Right.
Versus Stunning Steve Austin and his man buddy Huey Hogg, because everybody's doing the KFC thing.
Right.
He reminded me more of Huey Hogg from the Dukes of Hazzard, Boss Hogg's Stevie nephew.
Okay,
because he's in a white outfit and he's got the southern drawl, even though Huey Hogg didn't have that. So I'm going with Huey Hogg. So a joke will pay off later, Joe.
All right. Well, then I'll wait to discuss Mr. Hogg, pun intended, a little bit later on.
Mm-hmm. Now, this match I found interesting because it was there was a political statement involved in this match.
Okay.
In the fact that Steve Austin had a title, right?
The United States Championship.
The United States Championship. And Bobby the Brain was discussing, this was 1994, getting your Wayback Machine or your TARDIS. And, you know, this was when Japanese business, you know, were buying up all these things in America. They had bought Rockefeller Center and this and that. And at some point, Brain had them owning 3/4 of America.
Right.
And they cannot take this belt. He cannot take this belt back home. Even though I'm guessing, who was the good guy in this match?
The Great Muta.
The Great Muta. Okay. So I found it weird that he was selling it this way, but, you know, that it all went on, that, you know, that he's going to take the belt home. Okay, I'm reading something that I go on. But so this goes on. They're wrestling, and I'm enjoying. And at this point, I notice that each match is getting a little bit better.
Okay.
And that Heenan and Tony are doing a great job of announcing as crescendoing at the right time for each match, if that makes any sense.
Yes, it is. Yes. Each, you know, it's the layout of the show that, you know, you're building up to the main event match, and each match is, yeah, as you say, a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better, a little bit better.
Right, and each match, you get more energy at the end by the announcers.
Okay.
And to explain it, it's like the first match, like boom, 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 and then the last minute, you're like, ah, like you got the up point. The next match is like boom, 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 2 minutes to go. Ah, a little louder, if it's making any sense.
Yes.
And at this point, I'm starting to notice it. I'm starting to notice the ball rolling, if you know what I mean. And I'm like, that's pretty cool. And at this point, Heenan announces that that Aaron Neville lip synced the national anthem and he sang it. And that Neville's pretty good because his lips kept up the whole time. He didn't get behind or anything. And then he realized that Aaron Neville's sitting at the table next to him. And I'm going to wait for Aaron Neville to chime up at some point. It never happens.
There's no payoff.
Just sitting at ringside. But each time, like, Brain is like, he's like, yeah, I sung the national anthem. And Tony's like, you know, Aaron Neville's right next to you. He's like, what? Oh, hey, Aaron, how you doing? Good to see you. Great. You're a great singer. You're a great singer. And I'm like, that's another skeezy thing that I absolutely love. And while this is all going on, Stunning Steve Austin throws Muta out of the ring. And Huey Hogg helps Stunning Steve while the ref isn't looking. And in an early appearance with an earlier gimmick, Harper's Hanky as Triple H, Huey Hogg's Hanky. It's like, I'm like, wow, he gets rebranded down the line. Gonna be a big star alongside what's his name? What's the big guy's name that you like who has a Harper's Hanky? So
yes.
I found that amusing. That's the joke I needed Huey Hogg for, Joe.
Oh, okay.
I know you were worried.
Well, I'll wait, because Huey Hogg, as you mentioned, comes up a little bit later on. But I do just want to mention, it's funny, I did not go back and watch this event, but Bobby Heenan critiquing the Japanese buying up so much of the United States stuff,
mm-hmm.
A year and a half later, they would run an angle where Bobby Heenan sells half of one of the syndicated shows to a mm-hmm. Japanese conglomerate to show just their matches.
Oh, boy.
Which leads into one of their pay-per-views being a WCW vs. Japan show.
Gotcha. So now, while all this is going on, there are a lot of abdominal stretches, Joe.
Okay.
There are a lot. And they're
say.
Yeah, I know. They're playing it up. And then at one point, I like the whole Stunning Steve has the fabulous Muta in an abdominal stretch. And he keeps leaning out to the rope to grab the rope to get extra leverage.
Right. As you do.
As you do, you're cheating.
The referee didn't catch him, did he?
What? Well, the ref didn't catch him the first time. And the ref comes around. He's like, oh, this, you know, I'm going to do the, I'm saying the words, but it's more pantomiming for the crowd. It's like, hey, this rope is, why is this rope shaking? And Sonny Steve's like, I don't know. Wind? I have no idea. So he's like, all right, I'm going to go back away from this rope and ask the guy if he wants to quit. And as soon as he does that, boom, he does it again. And I'm like, oh, that's shady. I wonder if the ref's going to catch it this time. And the ref comes around again. Stunning Steve gets his hand off the rope. And I'm like, oh, but it's moving. I think the ref's catching on now. I think the ref's catching on. The third time was the charm. The ref caught it, and he shoved Stunning Steve. And I'm like, wow. I'm like, don't push back. You'll be disqualified because that, you know, you can't do that. Then, in a weird way, someone was disqualified because – in a rule I don't understand at this point, there's a DQ or something because somebody was thrown over the, you're not allowed to throw somebody over the top rope?
Correct.
What is this rule? This had me completely confused because they did it and nobody explained it.
Okay.
Other than
so,
they said, oh, he's over the top rope. It's disqualification.
Because the ring is elevated, you're throwing someone over the top rope, it's much more dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
To throw someone over the top rope than it is, say, through the middle rope, or just, like, kick them outside, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is the funny thing, is WWF is the only company, you know, around this time, and even up till now, obviously, they're the only company around, that did not have that as a rule. Mm-hmm. But it was more so in place that it was a cheap way for disqualification for the heel to keep their title.
Got you.
Where... behind the referee's back, the heel throws the babyface over the top rope. That is ingrained in the crowd that that's more dangerous because the guy is falling from a higher height onto the concrete floor. Referee doesn't see it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then babyface gets fed up. He's fighting. He hits the babyface, and then momentum takes the heel over the top rope.
Right.
Babyface gets disqualified because he threw the guy over the top rope.
Mm-hmm.
Referee saw it, babyface didn't do it intentionally, it was just momentum that took him. Now there's a disputed finish, now there's a reason for a rematch, etc., etc. And it's a way for the heel to keep the title, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
I'm a fan of that rule, but it doesn't work in a 2017 world of professional wrestling.
Where people are diving off 30-foot things.
We can even get further that there was a period of time, a year or two prior to this, where WCW implemented a rule that you could not come off the top rope.
Oh my goodness.
Because it was so dangerous. Like, if you want to come off the second rope, no problem. Coming off the top rope onto your opponent, that's a disqualification, and it was the same logistics. The heels would do it behind the baby faces, or behind the referee's back. It's informed to the fans that that's more dangerous coming off the top rope. Babyface does it, referee sees him, they get disqualified.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that makes more sense to me now.
Right.
Now, at this point, we have the International Heavyweight Championship.
Oh, boy.
Which is, I think, transitioning Kabuki Sting from Surfer to Crow Sting, because he's starting to have the black and white makeup.
So, we're still about 2 years away, 2.5 years away, but yes.
Okay, and he comes out in a lovely Three Amigos like homage outfit, as far as I'm concerned, and he's going to fight Bobby Roode's dad, Rick. And before the match even starts, out comes 7-time champ Harley Race.
Okay.
And the reason I remember that is because shortly, unless he won the belt since I saw the last pay-per-view where Ventura called the Harley Race the 7-time champ 34 times.
Mm-hmm.
I still think he's the 7-time champ. Comes out, you know, with Vader and says, you know, wins this match. We want our shot. And then he goes to take a shot at Sting, and Sting beats up this old man, and the crowd goes crazy because he's beating up an old man. Apparently that's their thing in Chicago at this time. I don't know.
Right.
But I found it amusing, and I love Brain giving his support to Harley Race. He's like, and Tony's like, yeah, he tried to attack him. He didn't try to attack him. He spun him around and said, sir, give us a shot at this belt. And he put his hand up to point at him. And then Sting hit him for no reason. I'm like, I love Brain's rewriting of history right in front of me. It's fantastic. So that goes out. He just, it's Brain making fun of Sting the whole match. Calling him, he's a Bart Simpson hairdo. I'm glad he got a Simpsons reference in there. But the thing that did shock me about this match is that this is like the third time I've seen Sting wrestle, maybe.
Right.
Because I think there was two pay-per-views you showed me where I saw Sting wrestle. And is this the first time I've seen Sting wrestle a singles match?
No, because the first time he wrestled the Great Muta.
Okay.
And then the next time it was the big 5-on-5 cage thing, okay, where it was like Sting captain a team against Rick Rude captaining a team.
Okay, well, this one, like I said, I've never been a Sting guy because I never saw him wrestle before we started doing the Gallifrey Birds. But one of those things I noticed, as I said, the pops are getting bigger and the matches are building and the announcing is building, is how quickly the fans just went crazy for Sting as soon as he came out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that blew me away. I was like, wow, they love Sting at this point. It's not for me, but, you know.
Right. So, you know, we go back to the pay-per-view from 1989 where he wrestled the Great Muta. A year prior to that was the big, like, he had, at that time, he had only been wrestling, you know, I think he started like 1986, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
So at this time, he's less than 10 years into the business. By far, outside of, like, say, upcoming in this next contest, Dustin Rhodes, he's probably been in the wrestling business the least amount of time out of anybody.
Okay.
But he was one of those guys that WCW was like, we're going to make this guy our Hulk Hogan and Ultimate Warrior kind of wrapped up into one.
Mm-hmm.
And from 1988 up until 2.5 years after this, when he becomes the Crow Sting, he was positioned, or actually, let's even say even less than that, like 3 months later, where Hogan becomes their guy, like Sting was positioned as the guy. Never mm-hmm. turned heel, never, you know, whatever, whatever. He was always the guy, so that's why the fans were like so into him.
Mm-hmm.
WCW did a really good job of building up Sting. And like, and another thing, he's another one of those guys who never left to go to WWF and come back or something like that. Or like, he was never in WWF first and then came to WCW.
Mm-hmm.
He was like the guy that they could always look at as like, he's been here the whole time.
Okay. So this match is going back and forth. And at one point, Bobby says, you know what you do? I'd like to see him, instead of give him Sting a headlock, I'd like to see Rick do that with some piano wire, you know, and really get him. And Tony's like, you're sick, Brain. And like, without missing a beat, he's like, what? I feel fine. And I'm like, that's just great. And he's like, once again, and then he's like, or you got to grab that windpipe when the ref's not looking and twist so it makes a sound. Like, you know when a dishwasher's done, Tony, and it makes that gurgle?
Oh, my goodness.
That sound. And Tony's like, Brain, you are a sick. He's like, we already did this. He's like, and I'm like, I like that. That's funny. At this point, Rick pulls off his high spot of doing his grind to the crowd and
right.
then tensing his buttocks for the camera.
Okay.
And then Sting pulls down his pants, and I don't know if that was meant to happen, but he pulls it down so they're down for a bit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he pulls them down and kind of tucks them, as
right.
far as I'm concerned. And then Brain's like, he's like, hey, Tony, it's only 7:30, but the moon's out. And the camera's trying not to get it. And it's fantastic. And then Vader and Race and all this stuff's going on. And once again, I did not write down who won this match.
Sting won the match. He
Sting
beat Rick Rude for the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship.
Okay, good. I was worried. So now, up next is Dustin Rhodes versus Bunkhouse Buck?
Yes.
Versus Bunkhouse Buck in a match that I think leans to the favor of Bunkhouse Buck.
Right, because it's a bunkhouse match.
Right, and I'm like, how could he even wrestle in this match? Because it seems like an unfair advantage. And I love Bunkhouse Buck, by the way.
Right.
He has a look. He has a look, and also, once again, Huey Hogg is with him, right? Am I right?
That's correct.
Okay, Huey Hogg is in it, and the thing I do like about this is Dustin, this is one of those matches, I'm like, oh, this is, I don't know what a bunkhouse match is, I'm not really sure on the rules, I guess it's a no disqualification match, but you have to, or a street fight match, but you have to pin them in the ring, I guess that's kind of the rules.
Sure.
But Dustin just blasts in the ring, he's like, oh, I'm not even waiting, just dives over the rope, and I'll admit I'm a sucker for that kind of start to a match.
Right.
Like, no messing around, that kind of thing. At this point, the hanky's back. He's strangling him with the hanky, and I love Harper's hanky. But basically, this is another one of those matches where you don't really break it down so much as it's people stripping off bits of their clothes and choking each other with it.
Right.
Or taking boots off and hitting each other, or whipping each other with belts, and I don't know, until everybody looks like they're a jelly donut somebody stepped on.
Now, I have to say that I want to throw this in, because I'm a fan of and hate this. So, there's, you know, obviously you're saying they're taking off the boots and hitting each other with the boots, right?
Mm-hmm.
In a normal non-bunkhouse match,
right?
If I take my boot off and I hit you with my boot, mm-hmm. or if I put my hand in my boot and then I punch you with the boot on my fist, mm-hmm. that's a disqualification. But if I keep the boot on and hit you with my leg, technically a stronger muscle than my arm, mm-hmm. that's perfectly all right.
But this is a bunkhouse match. You're able to do anything.
But there's other matches where, like, that scenario happens where, like, oh, the boot comes off. Babyface has his boot taken off. He then puts the boot on his fist, punches the heel, and gets disqualified because he hit the heel with a foreign object.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a thing that was just on his foot moments ago, and then if he kicked him with that same foot, he would have been okay.
Yep. Semantics, I
That's
guess.
That's one of the few parts of wrestling logic to this day as a lifelong wrestling fan that I call bullshit on.
Mm-hmm. Then, as all this is going on, I don't understand why there's brass knuckles come on. I don't know if they're brass knuckles, because Brain says there's something, and they go on Bunkhouse Bob's hand. And I'm kind of like, well, I don't understand. If anything goes, why are these hidden?
Good question.
I'm like, and why are we worried that the ref doesn't see these?
Right.
And all that's going on. But the best quote of the match is, Bunkhouse Bob's glove is more loaded than Foster Brooks.
There's a reference to, like, the kids at home.
That's not exactly. Google it, kids. Bing it if you got a minute. But he ends up hitting them after... After, Dustin gives a good whipping with his belt to Huey Hogg,
mm-hmm.
and but in the end, Bunkhouse Bob wins the match that his name is, he's named after. So.
Right.
But now you have something to tell me about Huey Hogg?
So, Colonel, the man you keep calling Huey Hogg mm-hmm. is Colonel Robert Parker.
Right.
Also known as Robert Fuller. A longtime professional wrestler going back to the 70s and into the 80s. And he had just recently, as of about a year ago, did a stint in AIW, a.k.a. Root Beer Wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Fuller is like an old-time Southern wrestler. And, you know, he's wrestled them all and he's been all these different places. And, you know, he's a very intelligent guy when it comes to professional wrestling. But the one thing that he is most notorious for in the world of professional wrestling is if you say to any like wrestling super fan who like knows their business, and you say the Tennessee Stud Robert Fuller, they're gonna say, oh, he has a giant penis.
Okay.
It is notorious that it's a ridiculous sized penis.
Okay.
That is the thing that he is most known for. So for you to call him Huey Hogg, to me, is hilarious.
Okay. So I've been doing that all night.
Right.
and you find that amusing. I like that. That's like me taking a stab in the dark and getting Sid Vicious as one of the one of the horsemen.
Going back on Who versus Woo.
That's right. Bringing it around where it all started.
Now, another nickname that he has is the Natty Daddy.
Okay.
Because his favorite beer is Natty Ice.
Mm-hmm.
Why is Natty Ice his favorite beer, Todd?
Why?
Because you can get it in a 30-pack.
Oh, my goodness.
And there was a show, an AIW show, that both he and Booker T was on.
Mm-hmm.
And he's down, you know, he comes to the building. He's, you got to make sure you have his 30-pack for him. He's there. He's holding court. He's playing cards. Old school, you know, wrestling guy. Booker T comes down and says, and I got no problem talking out of school about this locker room shenanigans or whatever. And Booker T comes down and goes, God damn, Natty Daddy, still drinking that shit?
That is fantastic. So that's in his rider contract.
Yes, is that 30 is in pack his rider. Natty. 30-pack of Natty Ice waiting for him when he gets to the building.
That's ice down, right?
Oh, yeah, in a cooler, sure.
You gotta have that. You gotta have that.
Listen,
so
this is why AIW is one of the top companies around, man.
Oh, and you know what? I figured everybody would get a 30-pack of root beer, but he wants his natty, so it's okay.
They actually just signed a lucrative deal with Coca-Cola and Coca-Cola products, so.
Oh, my goodness. I don't know which.
Does Coca-Cola have a root beer? They do. Barks root beer is theirs, yes.
Barks. Cross-promotion, I guess. I don't know. But at this point, we hit the grudge match with the boss, Springsteen, apparently.
Right.
Versus Vader and Harley. Seven-time champion Harley Race.
Harley Race out again.
Right. So I'm not even going to discuss this match other than one thing.
Okay.
Vader moonsaulting off the top rope.
Right.
That's it. That's the highlight of this match. I've never seen, what is he tipping the scales at? Like 250,
around,
260?
Around this time, he's probably close to like 350.
350?
Yeah.
And he goes up to the top rope, and I'm like, all right, this whole match is just two big guys beating on each other. Other than, I think at one point, Vader's eye popped out of his head, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
And it's funny you say that. There's actually a very famous match that he had several years earlier, as I pull it up. February of 1990, Vader faced Stan Hansen. Due to an exchange of stiff punches, Hansen unintentionally poked Vader's right eye with his thumb, which caused the eye to pop out of its socket.
Okay, we don't need to talk about that.
Right, listen, you brought it up.
It looked bad.
Right.
It looked bad, but
so
he goes up
to
the
top. So
I
guess once your eye pops out, it's prone to popping out again.
Oh, okay. It's like the Lethal Weapon shoulder socket thing?
Sure.
Okay. That's the technical part of it. So, but he goes up on the top rope, and I'm waiting for the boss to get off the ground and, like, you know, do the whole thing where he's like, oh, I'll throw you on the mat and then do something. But Vader actually moonsaults off the top rope, and I'm like, this can't be good. Like, that. Oh, this could go. But he nailed it, and he ended the match, and I was like, that was pretty cool. But this might be the boss's second best match after the Hell in the Cell. That's as far as I'm.
So I have to tell you, so he had just recently left WWF.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there he was called the Big Boss Man.
Right.
Here he was called the Boss.
Right.
And his outfit was very similar to that of the Big Boss Man.
Right.
So WWF sued them.
Okay, I have a question now because we go backstage and Bockwinkle, is that his name?
Nick Bockwinkle, sure.
Says, you know what? We can't have this anymore, Mr. Boss. And he's, I'm taking your cuffs and stick. And you're no, and everybody's like, he's no longer the boss. Does right. that have something to do with what you're about to say?
Absolutely does.
Oh, okay.
So due to the lawsuit, he's no longer allowed to be the boss.
Mm-hmm.
He then goes through a series of vignettes on TV where he becomes a guardian angel.
What?
You're aware of the guardian angels, correct?
Oh, I thought you meant like
Like with literally wings
like
and everything?
The biblical
no.
Kind. Okay.
With the red beret and Curtis Sleewell.
Oh, yeah, those douchebags in New York, yeah.
Right, so he becomes a guardian angel and is now the guardian angel.
Ugh. And they sue.
Then they become too difficult to deal with, so they just turn him heel, and he goes back to his pre-Big Boss Man character of Big Bubba Rogers.
Ah.
And then he just goes from Big Bubba Rogers to being Big Bubba, or as Dusty Rhodes would call him, Big Bubber.
Okay.
And then he would go back to WWF as the Big Boss Man.
And that's where he'd end his career and retire, and he's down in Florida or something, right?
No.
No?
No. Don't you remember? He was hung at WrestleMania 15. And...
never to be seen again. That's right. The Brood got him.
The Brood got him, yes.
Not to be confused with the ones from the X-Men.
Right.
Okay. Which would be interesting, though. They swapped. So now we get to the last match.
Right, the main event of the evening.
The Ric Flair versus Ricky the Dragon Steamboat.
Correct.
Who, by the way, let's bring it full circle, and it's poetry because it rhymes, was in the Mean Gene Okerlund part of my brain that Ricky the Dragon had never wrestled for anybody other than the WWE.
Whereas he wrestled Lex Luger on the first Gallifrey Birds that you had to watch and was part of Sting's team in the last Gallifrey Birds that you had to watch.
So maybe I blank some shit out. I don't know. I'm sure you remember everything about the Aztecs in the first Gallifrey Birds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So at this point, Ricky is the good guy, right?
Right.
Ricky, Rick Flair is the bad guy.
Well,
and
because
this is something I noticed. I was like, oh, well, Ricky the Dragon was always a good guy. And I even thought, I think I talked to you at the store a couple times where you're like, who were people who were never flopped from heel to face or face? They stayed there. And I think like one of the few that we came up with, if it was ever, like, you know, like, even if it wasn't, it was just a little bit. You were like, Ricky was almost always a good guy, right?
Correct.
So I was like, well, he's not a bad, and they're booing him. And they're cheering Rick, and I'm like, this is, you know, the last pay-per-view I saw was 91, and he was the bad guy there-ish. So I'm like, did they turn him? And then as it's going on, it was interesting to see Tony and Brain try to spin it like Roman Reigns. They're like, well, it's not that they hate Ricky. It's just that there's a lot of, Flair fans here. And just like the verbal dancing that they were doing to explain how the crowd was split on these guys when, you know, this is 1994. And I'm guessing, you know, you were supposed to be that, like, you were supposed to be your character and everything. And it was kind of weird to see all that, if that makes any sense.
It does. So Chicago, much like New York City, Madison Square Garden, much like Philadelphia, towns like that kind of are going to like who they like. Mm-hmm. And they're more heel towns, quote unquote, where they're going to lean a little bit more heavily on the heel side of things. Or in the case of someone like Ric Flair, you know, we talked a couple weeks ago on an After Dark about how, like, John Cena is one of those guys, like, no matter what they do with John Cena, you know, John Cena is always going to kind of be a good guy.
Right.
Whereas Ric Flair at this point in his career, and even years prior, whether he was positioned on the card as a heel or a babyface, he's getting cheered.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the problem a little bit with when they bring Hogan in 3 months later, is because it's supposed to be, it's Hulk Hogan, he's the ultimate good guy. Well, we immediately position him against Ric Flair, and WCW was primarily a southern territory. You know, they, even though they were trying to branch these things out, like running shows in Chicago and things like that, but they primarily ran from like Virginia to Georgia. Like, that was their territory.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to book these towns and cities and pay-per-views and TVs months in advance. So here they are trying to promote Hulk Hogan as a good guy against Ric Flair as a bad guy in all of these towns that love Ric Flair because he's their WCW guy. And not that they hate Hulk Hogan, they hate WWF so much, and Hulk Hogan is WWF.
Yes, they immediately see.
Right, he would just get booed soundly in all of these matches. And then they had to start booking shows in the towns where WWF was big and putting Hogan on top there to get those Hogan nostalgia, like those Hogan reactions. But the problem is, when you put him in the ring against not Ric Flair in those towns, he would get cheered. But when you would put him in the ring against Ric Flair, even in those towns, he ain't getting booed as much as he was, but Ric Flair sure as hell ain't getting booed either. Because, like, this is the point where, like, Ric Flair is, like, can do no wrong. He's getting cheered regardless.
And at this point, they show Beth Flair in the audience.
His wife? And,
yeah, Beth Flair was in the audience, his lovely wife.
Okay.
And I'm like, I can imagine that they're still happily married, right?
No. Sadly, they are not.
Another rest, that's two. Oh, my God. I don't know what to believe anymore. Makes me think Del Rio and Paige won't last.
I think they're the one.
They're the one?
They're the one that's going to last. They're going to show us all wrong.
Yes. But also in this, the announcer who, you know, does the, what, he's the famous guy.
Michael Buffer.
Michael Buffer comes out. And I want to know why they don't do this anymore, Joe. He announces all the upper-ups and everything. He announces the timekeeper, the president. That, like, where is that? I want that pageantry at my pay-per-views anymore.
Nah.
No?
No.
I like that. I thought that was interesting. But, and something I didn't mention earlier on that I noticed through this match, and I think it helped with the building of the matches, as I stated before, and this one was a big one because this went almost to the end, was the, and they don't do it anymore, is they don't announce the five, like, 20 minutes into the match, like 10 minutes left. I like that. That built a suspense in where there should be none for me at all of Ricky and Flair wrestling, and it's like 4 minutes, you know, five or whatever. And I'm like, and it was great because Bobby would be like, oh, my God, like, I'm the greatest timekeeper ever, because I would mention it 2 seconds before the announcer would, and it looked like I could keep the best time in the world. Like, see, I told you there was 2 minutes left, Tony. But that really did, and it gets down to, like, a minute or whatever, and you're like, oh, my God, there's only a minute left. And it's that ticking time bomb. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And at this point, the Shiv and the Brain are going crazy. And announcing, I'm like, it's really good. And then they do the whole like, he's got him in the I don't know what the move is, that he lifts him up kind of like a cross, he was saying.
Double chicken wing.
Double chicken wing. And he's like, that's the move that he beat him with 4 years ago or whatever. And I'm like, oh, this is cool. Okay, so I get that part of the story. And then he puts him on the mat, and I'm like, oh, and I'm not, you know, saying I'm the greatest wrestling fan ever, but I'm close. I was like, oh, all the shoulders are down. I don't know what's going to happen here, but this is going to be, you know, something messed up. And then they boom, 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 and then Ricky the Dragon's trying to get his arm raised, and the ref's like, no, and he's like, raise my hand. And they bring Nick Bockwinkle in, and it turns into this thing, and then they just go, Ric Flair's the winner, and the place blows up. And it's just like, here's our cheap, you know, credits rolling, bum, 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 bum. And I'm like, okay, I guess I needed to watch, was it Monday Night Nitro at that time?
WCW Saturday Night.
To get the explanation. I mean, I understood because they said it a little bit. Like, the one ref was saying it, and you could kind of get, he's like, well, his shoulders were down and this and that. And then they're like, give it to Rick, give it to Flair. And I'm like, ooh, another. Like, this would seem to have weird endings with a lot of the matches.
Right.
So, but it was an interesting pay-per-view.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Oh, and one thing I want to say, because I don't like when things that I watch have a weird racist overtone.
What?
And every time Brain would mention something about Rick, he might mention, like, I smell pineapple juice, or I smell, he's a pineapple punk. And the Shiv would be like, watch it, Brain. Like, watch it. I hope that's the last that we talk of racial insensitivity on this show.
Well, we save that for the end. But before we do, and again, of course, as I mentioned at the top of the show, since the Gallifrey Birds end up getting a little bit more listens, I would be remiss to mention, you know, you can get this show and the regular show that we do about comic books over at longboxheroes.com. And any way that you can help us out, just listening to the show, telling a friend, whatever, that helps out. I'm not going to have you go through a bunch of iTunes reviews, because we've talked about that well in the past. Those are bullshit. They don't really do anything in the grand scheme of things. But one thing that does help is if you go to our Amazon link at the top of the page, anything that you buy through Amazon, we get a little bit of a kickback. And on the main show, we typically will read like, oh, here's some interesting and notable purchases that we got through the Amazon link this week. So this week, because it's After Dark, and this is the first time that we're kind of mentioning it on here, Todd is going to read some of the notable purchases that we had from the Amazon click-through this past week.
Yes. Now?
Yes.
Okay. This is the Amazon Dark Amazon click-through. I'm just reading it as is. The Shibari Antibacterial Toy Cleaner and Personal Lubricant.
Mm-hmm.
Riding Crop 24 inches or 27 inches, new 100% fiberglass shaft horse whip with leather slapper, nice quality, the real thing, not that costume junk. A re-kink seven tail soft genuine suede leather equestrian horse sport flogger and whips with braided handle flogger. Black choker collar padded leather faux fur lined costume with leash and fabric bag, detachable leather chain and leash. Updated Hitachi wand with free premium wand essentials speed controller. And four locking fleece line cuff hog tie and three ring restraint collar, Joe. Thank you for whoever purchased these.
Do you think that was a couple people?
I think,
or do you think it was just one person who purchased all of those things?
I think it was many people. I think a lot of people have kids that need to be put in line, and they don't want them running away. Like, you know, the child, these are the leash things for the kids, so you don't lose them at Disney
World. Oh, is that right? What those are?
That's what these are. And there's a toy cleaner. That's got to be for kids.
All right.
So it's antibacterial. You're like, oh, the kids snotted all over Thomas the Tank Engine. Get our Shiarby antibacterial toy cleaner and personal lubricant out.
So thanks to everyone. Thanks to anyone who purchased all of those things. And I expect either a text message or a direct message, if you don't want to make it public that you were the one who purchased all those things, your secret will be safe with me.
And me, because I want to know.
All right. So I had to watch Doctor Who from the 14th season, would this be?
Yes.
The Talons of Weng Chiang.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, you know, these always go long, and I don't want to, like, go too long, of course, but there is a lot to discuss, okay?
Right.
So first of all, Todd gives me the DVD of this, and it's two DVDs, so already I'm hot, right? And I'm like, God damn it, it's two DVDs long. And he goes, no, they put special features and whatnot on them. So I see that one disc is all the special features, and the other disc is the show.
Mm-hmm.
Or the 2.5-hour movie that's broken up into six parts. Now, a lot of times, to pull the curtain back, I'll tell Todd, I'm like, yeah, you could skip this, or you could skip that on the pay-per-view, or you could do whatever you want to do. Sometimes they run a little bit quick. Now, I was already four and a half episodes, maybe five, into this when Todd sends me a text. He's like, hey, I got any time codes for that pay-per-view? And I'm like, nope. You're watching the whole thing, bucko. Now, granted, I say 2.5 hours, each of these episodes, they begin with the previous 2 to 5 minutes of the previous episode.
Right.
To really fill you in on what happened.
Well,
they could have cleaned that up a little bit for the DVD to make it like kind of a more flowing, continuous narrative, but I understand you want to air them the way that they originally aired.
Yes, this from the guy who's like, well, I got to get you the original one so you get the right music and the experience the way it is. You're getting the experience I got as a child watching these on PBS.
Right, when you watch these in 1977 when you were 3 years old or 4 years old or whatever you were.
Yeah, well, you have to remember they came over a few years later. They took the slow boat from England.
Okay. So, first and foremost, as we talked about in the previous Gallifrey Birds, how those episodes looked like a bad movie from the 70s that you would see on Mystery Science Theater.
Mm-hmm.
This, right from the onset, looked British. Like, right. You know how a lot of times you'll see like a still of something and you could tell like, oh, that's a soap opera. You don't even need to like know the players. You just see a still of something and you could tell like, oh, that's a scene from a soap opera, or that's a scene from like a daytime talk show, or that's a scene from a this, or that's a scene from a that. Like immediately you're like, this is British. It just had a British feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
So much so later on, I forget what was going on. I think it was like one of the scenes where, Professor Lightfoot and whatever the guy from the theater are like locked up.
Jago.
And my wife walks by and she's like, what is this Benny Hill shit you're watching? So another thing, we are immediately introduced to Lei Seng Chang. He's performing his magic, right? As part of this theater. Now, at first I'm looking at him, I'm like, oh, this is classic, fantastic fake mustachery at its finest.
Mm-hmm.
Then I realize he's wearing like some sort of like prosthetic head,
mm-hmm,
to make himself look vaguely Asian. And I only say vaguely Asian because he looked like a monster.
He looked fine to me. But
okay. But not as distressing as his little friend. And I only say his little friend because they call him like 16 different names throughout the course of the show.
The Peking Homunculus.
Right. Everything from Mr. Sin to my favorite, the Peking Homunculus.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, we don't get that reveal until a little bit later on. But when the doctor says Peking Homunculus, I'm like, show's over. I'm like, that's fantastic.
Oh, good.
Now, another thing, I look at the cover of this, and it's just, you know, the cover of the DVD, and there's a red-headed lady wearing, you know, period garb, and there's a man who's dressed like Sherlock Holmes on the show, and I don't realize that it's Tom Baker,
mm-hmm,
because I think Todd purposely went out of his way to give me episodes of Doctor Who starring the Scarf Doctor, where he never wears a scarf in any of the episodes that I watch.
It is literally one of the very few, it's the only storyline where he doesn't wear a scarf through the whole thing.
Right.
And it's, there are only very few ones where he goes through like an episode not wearing a scarf. And I was wondering if you were going to notice.
Oh, come on, Todd. The only goddamn thing I know about Doctor Who is a scarf. And you give me the thing where he doesn't wear the scarf. I was more offended by that than any of the racist stuff that we would see from here on out.
So, well, I was trying to throw you for a loop.
So, you know, obviously, Lei Seng Chang does his thing. They think, you know, we know that he's the villain. There's something up with this guy. There's something up with his little creepy friend, Mr. Sin. And he goes backstage and a drunk man comes and accuses him of like kidnapping his wife or making his wife disappear or whatever it is, right?
He knows he's involved somehow.
Right, knows he's involved somehow. So while this is going on, the doctor shows up and Leela, who's the companion in this one. Now, Todd did tip me off in this one that she's from some sort of weird world where people look human, but they've kind of devolved a little bit, and they're kind of more of like a warrior type thing.
Yes, they are a colony that went out into space, and through a series of events, got messed up and crashed on this planet, and they were there, and through generations, they had devolved and didn't know where they were from. They were like warrior race on this planet. So technically, they're humans from the far-flung future, but with, you know, no technology because it eluded them, if that makes any sense.
Right. So they appear And then they are on their way to the theater. They run into this guy, this drunk guy, coming out of the theater, who is attacked by a bunch of, like, Chinese immigrants or something. Mm-hmm. The doctor and Leela step in, and we get this right off the bat. Some of the goddamn worst fighting choreography I've ever seen in my entire life. It's shot poorly, it's in the dark, and it's just like, it looks like garbage. Like, I would be embarrassed to put my name on this, and the fight choreographers who did this 40 years ago are very lucky they're not on Twitter, so I could shame them for how bad this was.
Oh my god. Well, at least your hair is real.
Right. Most of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, one of them, like, all of them escape, except for one. They bring the guy back to the police station. They want to interrogate him. They don't trust the doctor because he's being cagey about things, of course. Because that's the way the doctor always has to be. He claims that he could speak Mandarin. They're like, no, we'll bring Chang. He speaks Mandarin Chinese as well. And then right off the bat, we start off with our racism of the episode, where the policeman says it doesn't matter because all these Chinese, and he says it like that, look the same.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy. So, it was around this point where I had to figure out on the way I was watching these DVDs how to put the subtitles on.
Mm-hmm.
Because the policeman, Jago at the theater, his little friend, the woman who finds the drunk in the drink or whatever.
Oh, the cockney old lady.
Oh my god,
she's the best.
Todd, I did not understand a fucking word that half the people in this goddamn thing were saying. And while I said that this thing was 2.5 hours long, and they were repeating the first 2 to 5 minutes of every episode from the previous episode, there was a lot of times where even with the subtitles on, I had to rewind it back, and I'm like, okay, what the fuck are they talking about? What's going on? What did that guy say? Who's that guy? Where's that guy? Etc.
I have never rewinded a wrestling match that you gave me in my life.
Right.
But go ahead.
It's like, I missed something. Oh, well, we're moving on.
Well, I missed that abdominal stretch.
Oh, I got the first and third times he held the ropes, but not the second time. I'm
That's
lost.
That's right. Right.
So, Chang shows up, and he gives him, like, a little red crystal that we later learn, of course, is concentrated scorpion venom. Because, you know what? Of course it fucking is.
What else would it be?
And then we go back to Jago's little friend is afraid to go into the basement of the theater because he saw a monster. And the cliffhanger of this is we get to see the giant rat that's living in the sewer. Now, I will say this. Giant rat, not as bad as it was hyped up to be. Because whenever you give me these Doctor Who episodes, I am contacted by the Doctor Who listenership of this podcast. And they're like, mm-hmm. Oh boy, Todd's fucking sandbagging you with this shit. He's giving you the hot garbage of Doctor Who. To which I respond, isn't it all hot garbage? But no, no, no. They're like, oh boy, this one's notorious. Like, oh boy, this one's bad. Or, oh boy, you're in for a treat, you know? And they're like, oh boy, where do you see how bad this rat thing is? 1977, TV, the limitations they were dealing with, I'm fine with the rat. The rat is no big deal.
Right.
Now, where we do run into some more problems is, as we get into the second episode, is a lot of the colloquialisms, either of the time, or of what was supposed to be the 19th century, or the 70s, or British, there was a bunch of stuff
mm-hmm.
that they would say, and I'm just like, I don't know, and I don't care. I'm just moving around. I'm just moving along.
Right.
Like, there's, Jago says, like, oh, it's something as Newgate's knockers. And I'm like, I don't know what the hell he's talking about, and I don't care. It's obviously not contingent to the point.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, the policeman says, or Jago's the one who's the culprit of a lot of this shit.
Mm-hmm.
He says to the policeman that the doctor is sharp as a trout.
Right.
And again, I don't know what the fuck he's talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's here where we learn that Chang is hypnotizing people, mostly women, to give to his master who lives down in the sewers, who is doing something that not only caused the giant rats, but also caused him to be, like, deformed and
right.
weird.
Mm-hmm.
But he needs these women to repopulate his life essence.
Right.
So
he's
that
stealing
he can
their
travel
energy,
back right. to his time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm completely on board for all of this, right?
Right.
And again, we'll get into his master, who is Weng Chiang. And don't say the other name yet.
Okay.
Because that's another one that they do a reveal on later. So, I love him. The villains in these Doctor Whos are great.
Mm-hmm.
They're the hammiest, overactingest bunch, and I love them all, and I want to hug them. Is there a Doctor Who in the future? I don't care about, like, oh, well, this is the one where four Doctors got together. Who gives a shit?
Mm-hmm.
Is there one where multiple villains get together?
Not really.
Then fuck Doctor Who. They don't know what they're doing.
Right.
Like, I needed to have the guy, the villain from the Aztecs, and I need to have this guy. You know, I need to have all these guys as, like, a super team of villains, just hamming it up all over the place, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then also in this, we're in the second episode of the six. There's also an extended montage of how we beat it over our heads of how uncultured Leela is.
I love Leela.
Okay. She's great. She's a delight. She's a breath of fresh air. But one of the things that we can get into, like, there's the whole subplot later on in this where Jago and Lightfoot are, you know, they're trying to help the Doctor because Jago's convinced the Doctor works for Scotland Yard. And they got caught up all in this. That shit can all be cut out. Get rid of it. You don't need it. You know, after the sixth time that we're like, oh, that Leela sure is uncultured. It's like, all right, we get it. I got it the second time. We're up to six. And it was around this part, okay, where I realized what the gimmick of Doctor Who is, Todd.
Because she even says it, but go ahead.
Okay, no. I don't know what you're going with.
Okay.
Because I got a different take on all this.
All right.
Doctor Who is a boorish idiot, a dullard and dumb person, but he surrounds himself, companions, with people who are stupider than he is, and goes to different time periods where by default he is the smartest person around.
No,
that
but okay.
is the underlying plot of pretty much every Doctor Who storyline outside of he eats an apple and yells at a little boy.
Okay, no. His gimmick is he pretends to be a dullard.
Mm.
I know where this is going to go. But literally his thing is, especially with like the fourth Doctor and the second Doctor and some other guys, is he pretends to be a dullard or less than he is, and he will always catch the villains off guard. Like, do you know what I'm trying to say?
Right.
And I know, like, you get all the jokes that could come my way, but that's really what it is. And then there's that one point where what the Doctor really is a show-off. Because there's one point where he's like, Leela, do you know what this is? And she just looks at him, she goes, you're just asking me so you can tell me. And then he proceeds to just tell her what it is.
Right, and see, that's what I'm talking about. He surrounds himself with people that he himself is not smart, but he surrounds himself with people who are way dumber than he is, so he can appear smart.
No.
Yes.
But
absolutely, 100%.
No, but that's not it. But what he does do is he attracts and he likes people who, if you're not smart, but are at least brave and willing to make the right decisions. That's one of the things about the Doctor. But.
Right, so they get the body, and it's also around this time where the police chief says that we've got a couple inscrutable chinks on our hands, and we've reached the peak of racism for the whole thing. It's all downhill from the racism from there. It's just kind of like it's no longer shocking. Like once you hit that like episode two of six, everything else is just downhill.
At this point, I would like to address the racism in this
Go
episode.
Ahead.
In the whole series. It is. It's bad at times. And I acknowledge that. And I get it. And I understand it was 1977. There's also a part of it that where I don't... the whole, like, how they act and talk, like, that's, like, you know, the stereotypical, you know, celestial character, like the magician. But I have no problem with a cop in England in the 1800s being a racist. Do you know what I'm saying? Does that make any sense?
Yes.
Like you're like, oh, there were no racist people in the thing. Now, the whole thing where, you know, they talk in the typical stereotypical Chinese language, that's different. But I also think at times, and once again, I am not defending that it is, you know, racist, really racist at times. But I think a lot of times that, like, the magician was playing it up so people wouldn't, do you know what I mean? Like, he was smarter than he let on and all this stuff. But it is what it is. And I think if you take that away, written and looking, take away the fight scenes that you hate, it is one of the best written, best looking classic episodes of Doctor Who because of you're in England. You can find a Victorian looking part of town and film. And they did that. And I think it really works in this. And I don't care what you say. I love Jago and Lightfoot. And they eventually got those radio dramas. They got their own line.
Terrible.
That they solve crimes in Victorian England.
Right.
And I know you want to listen to all those. I'll get you copies.
Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
So
I love Jago.
So it turns out, in Lightfoot's house, he has, like, this cabinet,
right,
which is what Wang Chiang is trying to get. Now, is this thing supposed to be, like, his version of a TARDIS?
They explain later that he's a guy who tried a different version of time travel that went down a scientific dead end, and he's famous in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So the doctor knows who he is, but he's trying to, you know, tell him, you know, this didn't work. This is what made you what you are. This time machine, we never see it again, and we've never heard of it before. Everything you get is from the information in this. There might have been in comics or the novels. I don't read all of that. You know what I mean?
Right.
But it's not a TARDIS. He's just a guy in the 51st century who tried to work on time travel, and it was a bad idea, and it wrecked his body. And if he does it again, the doctor's like, you're going to destroy everything by doing this.
Right. If he doesn't have his little ashtray, which we'll get to later.
Well, even if he does have it.
Right.
It doesn't matter. But go ahead.
So they go to Lightfoot's house to try to get this. There's, like, a little bit of a scuffle. And there's actually, for this time, a really cool stunt where Leela jumps out the window, right?
I love that scene.
Okay. Fantastic. A+, best moment of the show. However, it's then followed up by Chang shooting at them with a gun, and they have ADR'd in, like, old Wild West gunshot noises, like, that don't fit what would make a sound of, like, any gun for real. And I'm just like, sorry. Oh, it took me immediately out of that really cool stunt.
Joe with his firearm knowledge, but go ahead.
But if you heard it, it was like, oh, it's a John Wayne movie. No, it's Doctor Who. Anyway.
Okay.
So, they attempt to go back to get to the secret passage at the theater. The doctor is going through the sewers one way. Leela goes back another way because she follows them as Chang goes to kidnap a girl.
Right.
She sneaks back and then, like, puts, like, disguises herself as a girl so she could try to get the jump on Wang Chiang. She's now in the tunnels. They fight off the rat. Now, I have to mention this. It was the 70s. It was BBC. I don't know what sort of rules or whatever there were. But Leela's wearing, like, an all-white outfit, and she's rolling around in the water. Things got a little risque there, Todd.
They didn't show anything.
No, but, again, that white got wet, and you could see through that she wasn't wearing a bra underneath. And I'm just saying.
All right, you have your phone near you, right?
I do.
Okay, as you're going, I'm going to find something and send it to you, so keep doing your thing. And I'm going to show you what Leela wears in all the other episodes.
Okay, and I was going to ask if Leela was another Doctor Who companion who also posed in the nude.
No. She never has. I think she's been naked in a movie or two, but never posed in like a skin mag.
All right. That's a missed opportunity there.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, Wang Chiang tells Li Seng Chang that, like, you failed me for the last time. You suck. Myself and Mr. Sin are going to take care of this. And it's a little bit later on that we find out the history of Mr. Sin, which Todd had mentioned. He's better known as the Peking Homunculus.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't write this down, but I did have to make note of this. Mr. Sin, a.k.a. the Peking Homunculus, is a robotic toy constructed with the cerebral cortex of a pig. He almost caused World War VI when the pig part took over the toy's function.
Right.
And he is just a hideous-looking thing who just has no soul. He's a horrible monster, and if Wang Chiang was not as awesome as he was, he would be my favorite thing of the show.
Mm-hmm. But he's fantastic, and there is another homunculus that shows up in the modern Doctor Who, but it's not as cool. And less Chinese looking. But so yeah, I do love, and he ends up hating humanity. That's one of the things that is he goes berserk. And the doctor mentions it earlier, which comes into play later.
So Todd sent me a picture of what Leela usually wears in the show, and I approve wholeheartedly.
Let's just say Leela was one of my early crushes growing up.
Hmm.
So. But go on.
So, the doctor and Leela go to the theater while Chang is performing a trick. And I will say this was also a very cool sequence with the card trick and him throwing the card up there and he's going to shoot it out with the gun after they've already had these incidents, like, kind of, like, not in the public.
Mm-hmm.
And when the doctor kind of, like, shows a little bit of balls of, like, he's like, okay, hold up the deck of cards and I'm going to shoot just the ace of spades or the ace of diamonds. And
right.
The doctor like moves the deck right in front of his face.
Right.
Like, come on,
that's
you
a
son
great
of a bitch.
Scene.
Huh? Let's see what you got, you know? And I'm like, oh man, that was kind of a ballsy move. I liked it. So then this is, you know, Li Seng Chang, you know, leaves. They find him in Opium Palace where he like kind of like smokes himself to death, I guess.
Well, what had happened is that he had betrayed like the trust of Wen Jiang.
Right.
So he ran off into the sewers where the rats were, and the rats mauled him.
Oh, that's right. And his leg got all messed up. That's what it was.
Leg got eaten. Like, which was one of those cool things to me as a kid. To me, this episode is a lot darker than people fully give it credit for. Like you said, like he's moving a deck of cards close. He's like, shoot me in the face. I dare you. And then the other thing is this is he literally gets mauled and he says it in a story for a show about kids. He says, I got mauled by the rats. I woke up in their pile of food, which the doctor goes, yeah, their larder isn't exactly hygienic. He's, yes, I'm in this rotting meat. And I crawled out of there, and I know I'm going to see my ancestors because I only have one leg left, and I'm bleeding out. And I've just decided to go into that great beyond by smoking opium myself into oblivion. And I'm like, holy crap, this is a kid's show.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I always thought it was very darker than people gave it credit for. But go on.
So Dr. and Leela find him because they know what happened. He dies, but before he dies, he gives them like a clue to where Wang Chiang is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Wang Chiang has his women. He has the cabinet. But his goons forgot his special bag, right?
Right.
That had all of his like tools and instruments or whatever the hell it is.
And the key.
And the key, which is like this weird, like, ceramic ashtray looking thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they feel that it's back at the theater. They go back to the theater. It's not there. The doctor, you know, the doctor and Leela must have it. The doctor and Leela are at Dr. Lightfoot. You know, I say Dr. Lightfoot's at Lightfoot's. Now, in the midst of this, we get the reveal of Wang Chiang's face.
Mm-hmm.
And They only do it one time, and I'm glad that they did it one time, because if they did it like a bunch, like, oh, it's like, oh, here's the reveal, now we're just going to show it a bunch.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad they didn't do that. Whether it was a budgetary reason or whatever it was, I thought it was a nice touch that they didn't just keep kind of going back to it. Like, you see it that one time, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it was caused by, you know, as Todd mentioned before, the cellular collapse, because he tried to perfect this time travel stuff that only, you know, Time Lords can do.
Right.
So he still wants to go back to the 51st century, and, you know, the doctor, they meet back up at Lightfoot's place. The doctor's like, okay, I'll give it to you if you let Jago and Lightfoot go. They get back to his lair. He goes, okay, you have to let Jago and Lightfoot go, and you also have to let the girls go. They get into another scuffle, and it's also during this scuffle where Mr. Sin is, like, piloting, like, a giant dragon's head that shoots lasers.
He climbs into, like, a statue that has lasers in his eyes.
Right, and we also learn that Wang Chiang's real name is Magnus Greel.
Yes.
Which is fantastic. Which right. is, like, the coolest name for a villain ever. I love it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I didn't love this guy already because of his hammy overacting and he's just, like, yelling for no reason, like, now he has, like, the coolest name ever.
Right.
So, Mr. Sin turns on Greel, because the doctor convinces him that if Greel tries to escape, it'll just, like, destroy everything.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Sin... What's up?
Plus, they said earlier that Sin just, as whatever happened to him, just hates humanity as a whole. So he's like, oh, I'll just start killing everybody.
Right.
So, but go ahead.
So that was cool when he was, like, blowing up the table and they're trying to get away and everything else like that. And then that's, you know, so they push Greel into whatever the little thing that he was putting the women into so right. that he could absorb their essence. He disintegrates. Everybody's fine. Doctor and Leela leave in the TARDIS. Jago and Lightfoot are there, still confused by everything because they're dum-dums.
Mm-hmm.
And then the show ends. Roll credits.
Right.
Again, this was not terrible. My only complaint about it is that it could have been tightened up a little bit.
See? And I like it just as it is. I like those Gordon... Our Lightfoot and Jago scenes. I think Jago as the pompous, brave coward is fantastic.
Was this his first appearance?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I can see, as being a fan of Doctor Who, watching this and seeing this character kind of appear again, seeing this character getting more to do, perhaps... have more adventures, but in this isolated 6-episode story arc, he did nothing for me.
Okay.
Like, he wore on me. I'm like, okay, I get it. You know, he's, you know, as you say, he's a pompous, brave coward. But then, like, him and Lightfoot get together, them playing off each other. They both have, you know, they both speak, like, a little too British for me. I'm trying to follow along in the subtitles. I'm like, all right, guys, give it a rest.
My favorite line of Jago's is when they get captured, he's like, well, we're up the corks. I'm like, what is up the corks? What does that even mean? I love
that one written down. There was a bunch of other ones that I had written down, but I forgot what they were. Like, yeah, okay, so I had up the corks. I had painted drabs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. and then they said, like, opazudix?
That one I don't know.
And that was the one, like, that was one of the ones I'm like, what the fuck did he just say? And I kept going back and going back and going back. And, like, it was just one of those things, like, they say a weird thing, and then it never leads anywhere.
Right. They're just classic British phrases.
I guess.
You know what you need to do with that list?
Crumple it up and throw it to the garbage?
Bring it to the shop.
Okay.
We know a translator.
I don't want to bother her. I saw she had a bad day the other day.
That happens.
But all in all, I enjoyed this iteration of Doctor Who as well. You know, as I mentioned before, just could have been trimmed up. Like, I'm not saying, like, oh, cut, like, instead of 6 episodes, it should have been 2. It's like, instead of 2 hours and 30 minutes, like, I think if there was a version of this that didn't have, like, the previous, like, it was all cut together as, like, one continuous thing, you probably wouldn't be hearing this complaint from me.
Right.
Like, I probably would have liked...
You could have fast-forwarded through the credits and stuff.
I did, but I don't like doing work.
Right.
Like, I'm like, oh, you're making me do work. Now I'm even more mad.
Because they, I do have versions of certain episodes, none that were ones that I picked for you, where they are at, like, cut into movies.
Right.
And the way it is because you have cut scenes, is you don't even know where they're cut. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
And you don't even know where they're mashed together, but you don't get any of the cliffhangers, because the cliffhangers resolve, like, you know how, like, I agree, like, the Doctor Who are like old bad serials. It's like, oh, well, I'm about to get run over by a car. Cut to next episode. I step out of the way. You know what I mean? Like, they're not these big dramatic get out of danger things. I get it. But when you watch them cut like that, there is no, this is a cliffhanger. Cause it's just like, oh, there's a rat. We run away from it. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
Like, and it doesn't, to me, it doesn't work when you watch them that way. I don't know. Like, I would never give you one of those. Cause I you wouldn't even know where half the cliffhangers were, where an episode ended. And I don't want that, because you need the full Doctor Who experience, Joe.
And, listen, and I still have not had it yet, because the goddamn scarf doctor wasn't wearing a scarf.
And that was one of the things. If you roll back the tape to last week's After Dark, I'm like, there's something about this episode. I wonder if Joe's going to notice.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's the goddamn scarf doctor not wearing a scarf.
But it's the... you know what? We'll discuss this later. Right. I'm done.
All right, so... this has been a long episode, as these Gallifrey birds tend to be. Next week's After Dark will be back to a normal time frame.